Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How have attitudes toward breast cancer changed over the past three decades? When Nancy Brinker's 36-year-old sister was dying of the disease in 1980, she begged Brinker to do something to ensure other women didn't suffer the way she had. At the time, the treatment of the disease was less successful than today, and there was so much stigma attached to it that patients suffered not only fear, pain, and disfigurement, but often isolation and embarrassment. 2 years later, Brinker founded what is now called the Susan G. Komen for the Cure, and since 1982 has steered the organization toward raising billions of dollars for research and public awareness. She served as U.S. Ambassador to Hungary and United States Chief of Protocol during the George W. Bush administration and was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom last year by President Obama. Her new memoir is called Promise Me, How a Sister's Love Launched the Global Movement to End Breast Cancer. There will be a signing of the book tonight at the Borders store in Dallas on Preston, and the Dallas Race for the Cure takes place October 16th this year. Nancy, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's nice to be here.
I'm 39, and I have to tell you, for women of my generation, I can't remember a time when you couldn't speak openly about breast cancer.
I know it was very, you know, and you're right. This is sometimes an issue because younger women don't remember a time. But when I was actually a little younger than you, that's the way it was. Mm-hmm. You know, and when my sister was diagnosed in 1978, it was just a few short years after Betty Ford, our First Lady, had been diagnosed and was one of the very first public figures to speak out that she had breast cancer.
And that was a shock at the time.
Oh,
for people.
People were shocked that because, A, you were oftentimes, if you had a job and you were working, even in those days, you know, it was very hard for women to have climbed the ladder. But if you had a position, you weren't going to risk it by telling someone you had breast cancer. It was almost like a stigma. And then, you know, you couldn't print the word breast in most magazines, newspapers, TV, or talk about it on radio. You just would never have spoken about it out loud. So it was in this environment that my sister was diagnosed with the disease. She was 33 years old. We lived in Peoria, Illinois. And, you know, it just wasn't popular to talk about these things. And later, as her disease progressed, sometimes people would see her coming and would cross the street so they didn't have to talk to her. They were afraid it was contagious.
Hmm. And during this time, you and she both noticed how depressing the environments were,
right,
that people were being treated in.
Right. That, well, first of all, there were some very basic things that people, you didn't have. You had no patient advocacy, none. You did exactly what your doctor told you to do. And generally, you had to see three or four physicians in competing practices before you could get an answer about what you had and how you were going to treat it. And then they, you know, had territorial issues with one another. It was a very scary environment. And then also, there were no community cancer centers. There were some comprehensive cancer centers in the U.S., but not that many, and they weren't easy to get into. And sometimes you had to travel great distances to get to them. And there were no 1-800 numbers. There were no cell phones, of course, no internet. And also, young people can't remember a time like that when there was no internet and there was no ability to quickly reach out and educate. And today, when I look at the Komen website, komen.org, for anything anyone needs to know about breast cancer all over the world, in every city, every resource possibly mentioned, even conversation going on and event registration and on and on and on, it's really has been a miraculous cultural change. And that's what we set out to do 30 years ago.
My husband was watching a football game the other night, yeah, and the NFL players were wearing pink cleats.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, that was a program we developed with the NFL. Ultimately, they decided to go with another organization, but the individual teams all have come to us for programs because they know that we are the global leader in the fight against breast cancer. And we launched and fully developed cause-related marketing and put the color pink on everything. And it was very deliberate because this subject was so scary that people really couldn't deal with it and couldn't say the words out loud. And not that we wanted to pinkwash it, but what we wanted to do was make it feel approachable. And when we developed Race for the Cure in 1983, right here in Dallas, Texas, it was the first opportunity breast cancer survivors, patients, those who had lost people to breast cancer were able to convene in a place to celebrate survivorship, to celebrate what we did know. And at that time, even then, we had breast screening. It wasn't as good as it is today, but it was important to say to people, there is something you can do about determining whether you have this disease. And that really began a whole grassroots revolution. That one activity, which is now in 150 cities around the world and in America, helped convene the discussion about breast cancer and get people and make people aware that this disease was happening and people were dying in the numbers that they were.
I want to go back even further in time to your childhood, because there's a lot of great stuff in the book about that. Your first exposure, I guess, to the concept of breast cancer was your Aunt Rose.
Yes. In my book, Promise Me, I talk a lot about the history. And my aunt was actually had developed breast cancer in the 50s. And she was treated in New York with a Halsted radical, which was the only way women were treated before about 1960, 70.
This is the removal of the entire breast.
That's exact. Oh, not just the entire breast, but most of the muscles leading, even laying on the chest wall, all the way sometimes to the waist. People were literally, all you could see on my aunt was a heart, skin with a heart beating under it. It was, and then you were given oftentimes cobalt therapy, which was very diffuse and it wasn't focused and targeted like radiation is today. So the end result was devastating in appearance. And people, of course, had massive lymphedema, which is swelling of the arm, develop immediately. They had terrible side effects from this. And not the least of which, there was no reconstructive surgery, of course. So you can imagine why people felt very mutilated. And when my sister and I saw her without her clothes, I must have been, maybe 11, and my sister was 14. Susie forever had this image in her mind. And I knew the day she was diagnosed with breast cancer. That's all she could see. And that's what created the fear that didn't allow her to be really proactive about her care beyond seeing our local physicians in Illinois at the time.
And that doctor who performed the initial surgery walked out, and I wasn't there, but it sounds like very smugly said, "I've cured her."
Yeah, that did my sister's surgery, said, "I've cured her. She's fine." And I'm sure he thought he had. Honestly, I'm sure he thought he had. I don't think he was doing anything that he didn't think he'd done. Because after all, a lot wasn't known about the way this disease metastasizes, and particularly in young patients. In an older woman, that might have been true. But further scans and screens weren't done. And even in those days, it was known that women in my sister's category could have entered into a clinical trial. Could have had, there were only 8 or 9 agents on shelves to treat patients with breast cancer then. There was pitifully small amounts of money being dedicated nationally to breast cancer research. Again, no 1-800 numbers, no organization specifically dedicated to breast cancer. So patients had no real chance to talk to one another, to talk to physicians, to reach people and understand what to do.
And what she wanted was to get back to her kids and her life. She had a full life going.
That's right. She didn't want to go through this treatment. And ultimately she did. And she was very brave. She had 2.5 years of the most grueling chemotherapy, 9 or 10 surgeries, and nothing ever for even a moment stalled the disease. So it was a very devastating experience. And then we saw, as we finally got to a great cancer center at MD Anderson at the end, it was very advanced. And yet we saw people from all different cultures just pushing to get into the cancer center because there was nowhere to go in those days to be treated. Things have changed vastly since then. And I'm proud to say Susan G. Komen has changed the landscape of how people are treated for breast cancer today. We have all but eliminated death from very early breast cancer. It was, the 5-year survival rate was 74% when we started. And today it's 98% in America. And now we're closely watching the results of the targeted therapies that have been developed from all this research that's been funded. We're the largest nonprofit source of funds for breast cancer research in the world. And we've watched the science we funded now producing amazing treatments, targeted therapies that are keeping people with later stage disease alive longer. And we think by the end of the decade, it's going to further change the landscape. And our short-term goal is to get people to be able to live long, normal lives with a manageable disease and die from something else.
I want to talk a little bit about detection because it seemed like the message got out. Women were supposed to do breast self-exams.
Right.
They were supposed to get mammograms annually after the age of 40. The past year or so, we've heard different recommendations.
Right.
And some experts are saying, well, these don't save enough lives to justify the anxiety they put women through.
You know, it's when you get inside the sort of cancer community, we're not warring with each other over it. However, I'm outraged at the way, again, it's so much in the way things are communicated. So the Healthcare Prevention Task Force last year comes out with these recommendations that basically set a new table for people worrying about and thinking about this disease. Instead of saying, which we said and ultimately tacked on, it's not that you should screen less. It's that you should screen more, but with better screening tools. The real issue is, this is a technology gap, and there should have been outrage about that, not just, gee, I'm confused, but why am I confused? Because we don't have the kind of screening tools we need. And personally, when I walk through an airport and I walk through one of those screening machines and they can see what I had for breakfast practically, there's no reason we don't have better screening. It's only political will, and we should be outraged.
You could not have imagined as a young woman that this would become your life's work. But your mom seems to have set a great example for you. You call her the mitzvah maven, which
right.
I love. And you realize much later she wasn't a tireless volunteer. She was probably exhausted all the time, but she felt there was the right thing to do and that she was going to do it.
My parents always felt we were very blessed. We were a middle-class family, and my father ultimately became very successful. He was a small businessman, but not until he was a lot older. But hence, we were products of an immigrant family who were lucky enough to be here in the turn of the century. Many of our relatives were killed in the Holocaust. And yet my mother and father believed that democracy isn't free, that we had an obligation to practice good habits but mostly to help fix what was wrong, that we shouldn't just rely on the government to do it. We needed to get up and do it ourselves and help shape our future and what was going to happen with this great country we were living in. And so my mother used to bundle us up in her car every Saturday afternoon to take us. You know, we were just little kids. I was 5 and Susie was 8. The first time she did, many times that this happened. And, you know, it was hot in the Midwest. And our treat for going to one of her charitable causes was that she'd take us swimming afterwards in the nearby lake or in one of the rare swimming pools we had in town at the time. But in one day, she really got mad at us, and we were just complaining in the back of the car. We wanted to skip the charitable work that day and go to swim. So she got us out of the car, told us to get out of the car. She stopped the car, and she shook her finger and said, "Girls, I'm only asking you to fix what's wrong. People have died defending our country, and you're complaining because we're trying to solve some things to make our country a better place. And I want you to learn to be stewards of our country. Now, I'm not getting back in this car unless you agree to do it." So I stood there looking up at her. I had no idea what it meant to be a steward of anything. And Susie, my precious older sister, poked me and said, "Say yes so we can get back in the car and go swimming." So that night, Susie came and jumped on my bed and said, "Nanny, I figured out what we're going to do to be stewards. We're going to have a song and dance show in our backyard, and you're going to sing and dance, and I'm going to sell the tickets." Oh, great. There I was at 5, being told I had to hold down the whole show, sing and dance. So I got up that night and sang my best tunes. I had 2 Rosemary Clooney songs that I had, for everyone who's young listening, that's, of course, George Clooney's aunt. But anyway, when I got down from the stage, I thought I was terrific. My mother said I was terrific, of course. Mothers say that. But Susie said, "You know, Nanny, next time I think I'll sing and dance and you sell the tickets." So that's how I got to be a fundraiser.
Nancy Brinker is my guest. She's founder and CEO of Susan G. Komen for the Cure. Her new book is called Promise Me, How a Sister's Love Launched the Global Movement to End Breast Cancer. We'll return in a moment. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/PlanoCFP.
Your You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is founder and CEO of Susan G. Komen for The Cure, Nancy Brinker. Her new book is called Promise Me, How a Sister's Love Launched the Global Movement to End Breast Cancer. There is a signing of the book tonight at 7 at the Border Store in Dallas on Preston. And the Race for the Cure in Dallas takes place this year on October 16th. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So when you finished college, you went to work for Neiman Marcus, and right. Stanley Marcus gave you this sense that your job was to think beyond your job.
Right. And to never and to always be part of the family. He always made us feel like part of the family. And he used to call us associates with problem solving and with being creative, because he understood that if people felt as if they were part of the solution, they could figure out the solutions to the problems. And also he understood to make people passionate about what they were doing, to involve them. And also I watched him carefully. He was a great mentor, and watched how he sold. He never stopped selling, and he believed in what he was selling, and he never lost contact with the customer. He always had connectivity, and he was one of the most clever merchants I think ever known to mankind, ever. I mean, his lessons, if you look at Neiman Marcus today, I'm not giving an ad for them, but I'm just saying, if you look at the practices of the sales associates and what they learn, it's still the same thing. So I was lucky to have been there, and I took a lot of the lessons that Mr. Stanley had taught us about creating an experience. No means maybe. Never stop selling. Surround whoever it is, your customer, with the experience, and always present something new. Always have something new and exciting to talk about. So many of those lessons and so forth I took forward. And frankly, also I had a lot of lessons from the man I was married to for 20 years, Norman Brinker, who was well known in this area. He was the founder of almost the casual dining segment of the restaurant industry, a great operator of companies and coach to people, and a great man. And I watched him as he built companies, and then I watched my father very carefully, who was a small businessman, but very successful. And Daddy taught me more than anything, never to quit. You know, he said people often have, it's not that people don't have good ideas, it's that they quit. And so I was with a cousin of mine yesterday. We were talking about our family culture, the very few of us left in the family. But he was saying, you know, I'm not smarter than anybody. And I said, I know, you just didn't quit. Because really in time, if you look at the people who sometimes very, very smart, very talented people just stop working or stop working. And part of life is chipping away at something until you get it done.
What are the things that bonded you initially to Norman Brinker? He had lost his first wife to cancer. And what he taught you was that you don't have to let go of someone that you've lost.
Right. The way to really love someone, whether they're living or if they've died, is to let them be who they were and are. And his greatest gift to me was allowing me to develop myself, my potential. He always felt the worst thing you could do to somebody was stifle their potential, the worst thing. And so to the extent that he could, because I still needed to be a good wife and mother, he allowed me to follow my passion, and he helped me and he coached me. And it was a really wonderful relationship, and we were great partners, and also in the business that was built. He was just a wonderful, wonderful man. And he's one of the people I dedicate the book to.
Let's talk about cause-related marketing, because mm-hmm. this is essentially a household phrase now, and you are absolutely credited with having made it such. What did you first realize would be a good partnership in terms of cause-related marketing?
Well, I was wrong about what would be the first good partners, but let's talk for the listener. Cause-related marketing means associating with a business or a for-profit enterprise who's selling something and pairing it with your brand, with your messages and ideas, and therefore being that much more potent to create connectivity with the purchaser, the buyer. In our case, the important thing to do was to deliver a message, a conventional message about screening, about early detection, to people who were buying products because we couldn't get to them any other way. You know, remember, you couldn't use the word breast on TV. You couldn't talk about these issues like we are now. And also, I thought that if we could, and I had seen a few campaigns done, that if we could somehow pair it with products and do events, we could also raise a lot of money this way, that we could get a per point of purchase contribution, as long as the partner understood that we were very careful about which partners we would take, what messages they needed to deliver. And we were very careful about that and always have been. And at the same time, we realize you're dealing with people in business. So they have goals. They're in the business to make a profit. But they also want affinity with their customers. So a lot of our partners, and have been partners for many, many years, and this really developed in our early days of Race for the Cure. And I thought if I went to bra companies, I thought that if I went to products people were selling to women, that they would want to affix our cause on the intimate apparel products. And boy, was I wrong.
You know, I read that section and it surprised me because it wouldn't stop me from buying a bra. I would think, well, good for this company.
But you're very evolved and you're 37?
39.
Okay. So you're in a very different generation. But remember, go dial back 30 years to women who would have been my age then, your age. And then think about how they felt. And they were so scared of this disease. So their theory was, we're selling fashion and beauty and you're selling death and dying. We can't pair these messages. Mm-hmm. It won't work. So the meeting's over. And that happened more. And then finally I realized we had to somehow get people who were more involved in something very uplifting and that women were already doing. And that led to racing, running, sports. Because even in that day, we were doing high-impact aerobics. People, women were beginning to really run and run distances. So this seemed like a great set of products. And in fact, those were our first cost-related marketings. New Balance tennis shoes. Some of the products that people were selling to women running. Those were our first. And then it evolved into the really huge partnerships we have today. American Airlines, Ford, Bank of America, those kinds of sponsors.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. We'll go on the phones now. And first caller is Susan in Dallas. Hello, Susan.
Hi, ladies. It's so wonderful to hear this program, and it's so timely for me personally. My sister in Cincinnati was diagnosed on April the 8th with stage 3 inflammatory breast cancer and has had a very big struggle with her treatment. She had, they escalated the radical mastectomy and lymphectomy about a month ahead of schedule because the drugs they were using were not making as much headway as they'd hoped. In any event, after that surgery, she did her four-week checkup, and this was just less than 10 days ago, right after the race, as a matter of fact, in Cincinnati. We all attended. It was a wonderful event, and she was very uplifted. But a few days later, we were at her doctor, and unfortunately, her cancer is back aggressively. So we've moved to a new treatment program at the Simon Cancer Center in Indianapolis. And my question actually is regarding the American Airlines special lifetime promise and the $7.5 million that they're raising. I was reading this in the American Way magazine. For a special study of inflammatory breast cancer at MD Anderson in Houston, because I feel that we may, in fact, sooner rather than later, be looking for something like that because her cancer does not seem to respond well to the current therapies that she's been getting. Can you tell me more about how I can go about...
Yeah. I think the thing to do, since I don't really give medical advice and can't here, but I will tell you, the thing to do is to go on our website, Komen.org, and then look, or the MD Anderson website, because we funded this very large program and we have taken a very aggressive position about funding solutions for inflammatory breast cancer. It's a huge problem. And it's, as you know, one of the most aggressive types of breast cancer next to triple negative disease. We feel very hopeful about the work they're doing at Anderson, and that's why we've made such a significant grant. And American Airlines has been gracious enough to use it as a centerpiece of their philanthropy. So I would suggest a visit to either of our websites, and they will have much more information for you to look at.
One thing that wasn't understood when you started this work is the relationship between genetics and breast cancer. Of course,
right.
We know not all breast cancer seems to be genetically linked, but can you talk about what's changed?
Well, actually, and boy, has it changed. You know, I was so, actually, as it's turned out, you know, I had breast cancer a few years after my sister died. One of the very first grants we funded was Dr. Mary Claire King, who was at Berkeley at the time, who was one of the original scientists involved in discovering the BRAC1 and 2 genes, which is interesting because I'm BRCA positive. And so it's kind of bittersweet. You go back and I realize my sister was too. Mm-hmm. And so these sorts of discoveries, these sorts of roadmaps, if you will, are going to be the drivers of how we approach genetic therapy, which will be one of the areas of prevention. It won't happen immediately, but we suspect that within the next 10 years, we hope sooner, we will have strategies aimed at fixing the mutation, so to speak, on the gene that is causing this disease among women. Ashkenazi Jewish women are much more susceptible. But if you have the BRCA gene, and you should be tested if you have a high degree of familial breast cancer in your family, then your understanding and your needs of what to do become much clearer.
Talk about when you were diagnosed. First of all, there's got to be that, you know, you think about what your sister thought of in terms of remembering your aunt. You must have had instant visions of, oh, my God. And then the irony of the whole thing must have just been really hard to deal with.
Yeah, the irony was unbelievable. And somehow I falsely assumed that I never thought about me developing breast cancer, except that I was developing lumps and lesions too. They were all benign. But I think that moment was one of the most terrorizing moments ever in my life, because I realized that I did have the same type of tumor my sister had. But fortunately, because I was treated very aggressively, very early, but also, you know, I guess on the spiritual side, I maybe rightly or wrongly assume I've been kept alive all these years to do this work. I just couldn't face the idea of not being able to fulfill the promise. Who was going to do it if I didn't do it? There was no one else to do it. And I was devastated. And also because Norman and I had just been married a few years before. I had a young child. It was a very devastating time. And for many years, I've lived in fear that it will recur. And that's just the way it is with breast cancer patients. You never know if it will. And you hope that it won't. And you do everything you can to try to live a healthy and good life.
Nancy, this might sound like a really obvious question to you, but for people who haven't experienced this, why does breast cancer in so many cases seem to sort of redefine who women are and how they see themselves?
Right. Well, because, look, it affects one of the most intimate parts of your body and a part of your body that, you know, is involved in procreation, in your sexual relationships, in your entire physical relationships, whatever kind of gender sort of focus you have, whether you're it doesn't matter. It's a very important part of your body and defines a lot of people just in terms of how clothes are made, mm-hmm. you know, and the emphasis on breasts and all of it. It's and the breastfeeding. And so it's a very difficult thing for people to deal with. It's somehow not quite the same as when you get a skin cancer, yeah. you know, or you know that it. So it's still very, very difficult for a lot of women and particularly younger women to deal with.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Mesquite, where we will speak with Carol. Hello, Carol.
Hi there. Thank you so much for your work. Several years ago, there was also something that the Komen Foundation was involved in with the Turtle Creek Corral and the Women's Chorus of Dallas in creating this wonderful orchestral choral work called Sing for the Cure. And I wondered how if that has picked up in other parts of the country as well.
Well, thank you for asking. That has really been one of the beautiful parts of this work, is that we've had so many people. And the Turtle Creek Choir, not all but mostly gay people, came to us and developed this wonderful, wonderful symphony, this Sing for the Cure, which was a beautiful story of Komen and people with the disease. And I think it was a very poignant moment. It was reperformed last year, if that's a word, performed again at the Dallas Symphony Hall. But I think another thing happened which was really important. And you know, Susan G. Komen is dedicated to helping people of every culture and every sort of group in this country and elsewhere. So that my sister believed that nobody should have care any less because of the color of their skin, because of the amount of money they had, or because of their gender. And we are very active in the gender space, the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transsexual space, because we feel that so many people in these groups are discriminated against, quite frankly, because they face so much discrimination anyway. So we find that women who are lesbians sometimes develop the disease, and it's very aggressive because they don't seek care easily. They don't have care in some cases. They don't have relationships with their physicians that allow them to be as proactive. And so we worry about them, and we worry about times when political dialogue gets like it is today that pushes people even more into fear and into spaces where they can't feel proactive about their health. So that's just something that really bothers me personally, and which I often speak out about, because no matter, again, what difference you have or what gender you are or what culture you come from, you shouldn't be discriminated against for any reason.
Talk about how the pink ribbon became the symbol of Susan G. Komen for the Cure.
Well, my sister loved the color pink. And when she was homecoming queen when we were in high school, she had a dress with a pink ribbon down the front. And she loved that dress. And she was just so typical of the very frightened woman. And I thought to myself when we were doing this, well, you know, the red ribbon, AIDS had the red ribbon, mm-hmm. but that wasn't until a little later. But people started wearing them when we had used the color pink at some of our very early races, and they took little grosgrain ribbons and put them on themselves. We used it in our race, one of our first races for the cure in New York. It was hence sort of picked off by other people, which is fine. We don't care. I mean, we don't care who uses a pink ribbon, except that we want it to mean the right thing.
Yeah.
And whoever's using it is really raising money for the cause and reporting it that way. But it has come to mean the solidarity and the power behind this movement.
My guest is Nancy Brinker. She's founder and CEO of Susan G. Komen for the Cure and author of the new memoir, Promise Me, How a Sister's Love Launched the Global Movement to End Breast Cancer. There is a signing for that book tonight at 7 at the Border Store on Preston and Royal in Dallas. The Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure in Dallas takes place October 16th this year. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/PlanoCFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is founder and CEO of Susan G. Komen for the Cure, Nancy Brinker. Her new book is called Promise Me, How a Sister's Love Launched the Global Movement to End Breast Cancer. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk about when you were named U.S. Ambassador to Hungary, because it would sound at the outset like, okay, this is taking a break from the work with Susan G. Komen, but in fact, you brought that agenda yeah. with you to the work.
Yeah, it was really an amazing opportunity. I was asked to go by President Bush had asked me if I wanted to be an ambassador. At first, I didn't want to. I love my work. And then I realized this is a real opportunity to spend some time outside of the country. And it kind of had worked with my personal life at the time. And but it was, I also asked if I could be there because I was really concerned about the death rate there. After all, they've been a good ally of ours and a sort of a new democracy, and yet the death rate and the incidence of cancer was very high for what it should have been with their demographics and their amount of education and et cetera. So I asked to be posted there, and it was an amazing experience. And yes, it provided me a lens to look at our country, and particularly to understand where we had to go in the breast cancer movement in global health to really make the same kind of difference that we had in the United States. So it was a great opportunity for me to serve the country and at the same time learn about how to further engage and grow our organization.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Fort Worth and speak with Ron. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I want to say, as a 26-year cancer survivor, thank you for all the fantastic work you're doing. It's amazing the message you guys have gotten out, you've been able to do. Earlier in the broadcast, you said when you first got started, you couldn't even use the word breast.
Right.
I look at this weekend watching the NFL and all the pink shoes, the pink scarves.
How about that?
it's just absolutely amazing that here is the last bastion of unadulterated manhood in the United States, and you see the incredible, effort the NFL's gone through. It's amazing. I just wanted to say thank you.
Well, thank you so much. You know, it really was an amazing opportunity to be with the Cowboys on Sunday, even though we would have hoped for them that they would have won. But it was an amazing opportunity. Brady James has been extremely involved in the breast cancer effort, as have many of the players. I got to ride out on the field with Troy Aikman's mother, and although we were both too chicken to do the coin toss, I don't think any of us could have taken that on. But it was so much fun to meet the players and to see the honest, all of them walked up and thanked me for what we were doing. They understood the importance of it. Jerry and Gene Jones made this tremendous contribution by doing, and their daughter Charlotte, this great pink ribbon campaign on the field at halftime. And, who knows how many people saw that? It was just an amazing opportunity. And we were so grateful for that. This really, these kinds of events take our need to saturate the public to new heights.
Well, and it makes sense that, we tend to look at this as a women's issue, but even burly football players love their wives and their mothers and their sisters.
Of course. And, this is a case in Brady's family, and of course they see it and it's devastating, and it happens to their wife and, who might be raising young children or their mothers, it becomes, of course, a very personal issue. And men can develop breast cancer, too. It happens in a much smaller amount of people, but it can happen.
98% five-year survival rate is really extraordinary. How confident are you that at some point in the future, every woman will find a therapy that allows her disease to be cured?
I am an eternal optimist, and maybe that's because I was born in Peoria, even though I lived in and also lived in Dallas for 30 years.
Can-do
so
city.
That's a can-do, isn't it? And even though on a daily basis I feel beaten down sometimes by the academic elites and by the people who think that, we pinkwash things and we're like Pollyanna, I don't care. We've made tremendous progress, and we're going to make a lot more. We have never let people down in Susan G. Komen, and we don't intend to do that now. And I can honestly say with great comfort that by the end of this decade, and certainly by the middle of the next decade, we are going to have all kinds of targeted therapies. And my dream is that women who develop this disease and we can't cure it in an early state will have targeted therapies that can be used that are cost-effective. And frankly, they'll die of something else, that they will be able to live long lives, just as people with diabetes do. That's what it will look like in the short term. In the long term, I think we're going to very quickly see how to manipulate, use genetic therapy if there are nutritional substances that are causing it, what environmental factors might be involved. We're going to know all of that. And the research that we've done over these years is going to really, really play out, as it is already. These problems are never easy to solve, though, and they're never as quick as we would like. And if there's ever been a frustration in my life, that's it. I thought I could do this in 10 years when I made this promise to my sister, but it's not going to be 10 years. And I just hope I live long enough now to see the next great leap in progress. And I think we're in the middle of it right now.
Let me ask you this, Nancy. I can walk into a department store or a discount store or a 7-Eleven and buy something that is pink. And the assumption always is now that money is going specifically to Komen, but at least to breast cancer research. How can I be sure?
Well, that is a problem. There's a lot of brand piracy. A lot of people use the pink ribbon. I won't say a lot, but it does happen when they're actually not giving. So the trick is to always look at the label carefully. Ask the merchant where the contribution is going. And if you're at all suspicious, just simply say, I'm not going to buy this product until you show me clear labeling. Because our labeling of our products is very clear, how much money is actually going, the internet site for the company and for Susan G. Komen, so they can track the grant. It's very important to do that. It's buyer beware, because people are using pink because they think it sells products. But it doesn't happen as much as you think. And we're so careful about our partners and making sure they do what they're supposed to do. And we were designated by Charity Navigator, which is the private watchdog agency that watches charities, as at the highest level again for the fourth straight year.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Dan in Dallas. Hello, Dan.
Oh, hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
How's it going?
Great, thanks.
Good. I had a quick question, and I don't want to sound cold, but I generally don't like supporting, I guess, charities that in this case would be gender specific. So my question is, and I know that men can have breast cancer, but you mentioned, you know, Brady James, the other football players have wives and daughters and mothers. How much of the research is applicable to just all cancer, and how much is really specific to breast cancer and not as, I guess, useful elsewhere?
Yeah, that's a great question, and when we're asked, although I will tell you, with the amount of research funding that Susan G. Komen has done, remember, we're the largest funder, the largest nonprofit source of funds for breast cancer research. All of this research generally has application with many other types of cancer. It is not that it is so cancer specific to a site. After all, genetic research is gene research is gene research. And so we have helped many of the drugs that have been developed out of this kind of research, for example, Rituxan, is just one drug I can think of, which has been extremely helpful to people with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Many, many other drugs that have been developed also are used for other kinds of cancer diseases and other diseases. But we do support programs for men with breast cancer. We do support programs. Oftentimes, we do programs with prostate cancer groups and with ovarian cancer groups. So we're not, you know, and overseas, particularly Susan G. Komen, not only embraces breast cancer, but cervical cancer programs. So we do not just sit in a dark room and only focus on the disease of breast cancer. Breast cancer is many diseases. Cancer is many diseases. So to sum it up, at the end of the day, the research we fund is applicable and important research. That is applicable to the solution of many diseases.
I want to ask you about something that might seem trivial, but to people who have experienced it, it's not. Not everyone who has breast cancer goes through chemotherapy, but a lot who do lose their hair. And supportive friends will say, you still look beautiful, it doesn't matter. And it always matters to a woman who's lost her
hair.
Right,
I lost mine. I understand it very well. It's awful. It's cold. You feel physically cold, mm-hmm. you know, and it is awful. The only good thing is it's generally temporary. And until we find the kind of strategies that don't do that to people, and I think they're coming sooner than later, by the way, you know, we have much better wigs. We have periods of time where, you know, it goes by pretty quickly. It's not like you do. I'm not painting it with a pink picture.
Sure,
just saying. It is a very unfortunate side effect. And yes, it does matter. And yes, it bothered me very much. And I hope someday soon we won't have to worry about any of that.
What's the right thing to say to someone that you love who's suffering because for a while she doesn't have her
hair? Yeah, I think it's important to say, first of all, to take her to a great place where they make great wigs. Mm-hmm. I'm serious. That helped me more than anything when someone actually showed me. And in those days, when I had breast cancer 25 years ago, they had much better looking products,
right,
or less accessible. But today there's so many options for women, and you know, a lot of women just don't even bother. They just wear a scarf or a head wrap because people do have respect for going through the process now. They understand cancer therapy. And I think the best thing to say, always to say, and again, we have a great description of our program being a co-survivor. That's what we call it, mm-hmm. at Komen.org. And we have a lot of great tips for how to make people, how to engage with them and make them feel good and that you're supporting them and loving them. But I think, again, just saying to someone, I love you for the person you are, not because of your hair and who you are. You know, you are who you are, regardless of that.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Rhett in Dallas. Hi, Rhett.
Hey, good afternoon. It is a honor to be on the air with you. My name is Rhett.
Hi, Rhett.
I just want to How you doing? I just wanted to thank you, Nancy, for everything you've done. I was going to ask you about how much of the funds that you guys raise are going towards the immunotherapy research for breast cancer. But then I was listening to the last caller. He was talking about
applicability to other cancers.
Right, applicability to other cancers. So I'm a performer, and I've spent the last 5 years of my career basically raising money to help, you know, fund sarcoma research. Mm-hmm. My brother was a sarcoma patient, and we lost him last May. Mm. And so I can relate to what you went through with your sister as far as, you know, wanting to keep fighting even after you've lost everything. And my family started a corporation to fund some immunotherapy research with Dr. Shimon Slavin.
Ray, let me stop you. I'm sorry to rush you along, but we're just about out of time. So if you could get to your question, I'd really appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Well, let's just go back to that other question then. What are you guys doing as far as the immunotherapy research?
Yeah, thank you. Well, this year we took about a third of our research budget and funded many, many areas of prevention, causation, and certainly immune therapy support is part of that. And we have funded these sorts of activities for many, many years. So I would point you to Komen.org again and look into our research portfolio, and you will see how many of these kinds of projects and scientists we have funded over the years. Very important to support the immune system, no question. It's going to be a very big field of interest going forward, and we're going to have much more practical application.
What do you see as the right balance of fear of a serious disease and also optimism that you're probably going to be okay?
I think that the balance is that you do everything you can to live a good life and do exactly what, you know, if people would just listen, it does matter if you smoke. It does matter if you do these things. It matters if you drink a lot. And it matters that you do eat appropriately, good food that's, you know, it's hard to find good food sometimes. Seriously, it's hard to find vegetables and fruits that aren't sprayed within an inch of their lives, you know, and to eat as organically as you can. It's important to exercise. It really is important to do because your body is an amazing, resilient organism, and it's important to support yourself. And, you know, you will, because of your genetic code at some point, probably develop some disease, and we are living longer than we ever had before. But the important thing is if you're otherwise healthy and you keep yourself strong, you keep yourself as fit as you can, the chances of surviving it are far, far greater.
Was it hard to write the memoir?
Really hard to write a memoir because you go through everything sad and emotional and happy and things you've lost and been through in your life in a fairly short amount of time, things you thought you walked through. And it was a very bittersweet time. Reading old letters from my sister, reading, you know, going through my marriages, going through my life and my breast cancer and everything. It's painful.
Well, we are glad that you did it. So
thank you so much.
Nancy Brinker is founder and CEO of Susan G. Komen for the Cure. Her new memoir is entitled Promise Me, How a Sister's Love Launched the Global Movement to End Breast Cancer. There will be a signing for the book tonight at 7 at the Border Store at Preston and Royal in Dallas. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.